Okay.
EMS 8730. Hello, caller?
Relax, relax. We're trying to help you here.
This is not a job for everybody.
Losing fib now.
This is not a job to get rich or stuff like that.
Calm down. Everything's going to be okay.
We're the doctors of the street. That's what we are.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp. EMS Office Hours is a live, weekly EMS podcast for all EMS professionals.
Discussing a variety of EMS topics and bringing your EMS concerns to light. So turn down that scanner and turn up your speakers.
And join us to find out what's really on the minds of EMS.
Hey, good evening, everybody. This is Jim Hoffman.
And Josh Knapp.
And, of course, you are listening to EMS Office Hours. I want to thank you for listening to us live this evening. My voice, if you have listened to us before, sounds a little more deeper and more nasally than usual.
You got that sexy radio voice going.
I like to call it, this is my favorite time when I get a cold, is I sound a little bit like Frank Bantangeline from Godfather 2. I can do that imitation pretty good, so that's pretty good. I can do that a little bit, but other than that, you know, having a cold kind of sucks, so. But I wanted to get through tonight, because last week we didn't do a show, because it was a holiday weekend. I figured we'd take off that weekend. So I wanted to get through tonight and, you know, bring some information, some content out to the listeners. Two things I want to talk about before we get there. One thing is just a heads up to people. If you're not on my mailing list or following me on Facebook, you might not have heard.
Or following me on Facebook, right? Or on the group page.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have a.
This is actually kind of important, so.
I have a preferred partnership I just did with Limit Creative, and they have two web-based apps and iPhone apps, the Paramedic Review Plus and the 12-lead ECG recognition apps. And now if you become a part of Paramedic, you can get those apps for free. So if you are part of Paramedic, be sure to let me know so I can get those apps to you. And if you are joining anytime soon, be sure to check those out inside the members area, and you'll get the details of the video there explaining to you how to access that additional content as part of your membership. With that said, Josh, I know today there's been some, somber news and some tragedy within the EMS community. Fellow paramedic and lost a son very suddenly. I know they have a little bit of a 1013 going on. I want you, Josh, if you can. I know I don't have that much information on it other than what I'm reading via Facebook and some of the tweets I'm getting. But maybe you can just kind of go, just maybe talk about what a 1013 is for people that
Started
the country. And then maybe just give a little information about the what happened, if you can.
That definitely came up, and some people were saying, what's a 1013?
Yeah.
1013, for folks who don't know, is the radio code that's pretty much used around the East Coast for an officer down or MOS down, life and death danger. You know, don't spare the horses, get to the scene, help them out. And they use it now, or they've used it traditionally when – you know, somebody's taken ill or fallen on hard times or something's happened to a brother or sister in EMS, where generally it traditionally has been we get together, have a party at a bar, and the proceeds of the party go to helping out the people. Now in this electronic age, you can raise funds. It's a fundraising effort, and you can raise them. You know, Facebook is a great place. And so what – the tragedy is what happened is Eden and Tito Rodriguez, who are two EMTs. Tito's a paramedic now, but their son passed away this week suddenly. 16-year-old child passed away through a sudden onset. I'm not sure what the illness was, but it was a sudden onset and rapid rapid spread of this of an infection, I believe, and he died suddenly. It was unexpected, and you know, Jim and I have I was about to say bitched, but you know, spoken about how much EMS gets paid, and the people who do this full time. And yeah, you know, you call them professional, but you're calling them, not that people in volunteer world are not professional, but when you get paid for it, you get, you know, you get the right to call yourself a professional in it. And both these people have no other source of income, and they're now facing the funeral expenses, which we know in this day and age can run into the low five figures to bury their child. And so it's a call to arms. It's a 1013. It's a call for help for one of our family to help them bury their child. And there's you can go to Jim's EMS professional page. You can go to the Want New page, WANTYNU. There's several places on Facebook. You can probably find it. And there's a link to a fundraiser on Facebook. The goal is $10,000. Right now you have a little under $4,000, so they can pay for the funeral for their child. And it's a somber time, and the worst thing that a parent can ever experience, has been told, is the death of a child. So we want to come together as a family for these people within our group. So just go to, you know, like I said, go to the Want New Facebook page, and that's WANTYNU. And Jim will post a link on this show as well for where you can go and click on it. And give whatever you can. I mean, just, you know, even $10 goes towards that goal. And the more people we get together, the better chance they have of reaching it. And, you know, it's hard enough in this day and age. But to bury your child and then to have to worry about the bills is just over the top. So let's come together on this one.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. You know, I think, too, they have a goal of $10,000, which you think about, that's so minimal compared to the loss that they have, you know, and especially with the holiday season, makes it that much more difficult, you know. So just
and
everyone
not,
listening, it, just please,
it's
to, please go check that
debt.
Out. Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Funerals go for, you know, that's a starting range of a funeral. I mean,
right.
You know, funerals easily go $15,000, $20,000, and that's for a very modest, you know, economy funeral.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a little bad.
And, you know, Josh, too, you always see so many of those things out there on Facebook and in forums and things like that about help another member's service, needs your help, that somebody got hit by a car or somebody was in a car accident or somebody, you know, has cancer and stuff like that, and it's they're always out there. And if you've never hesitated before in joining in and helping one of our own in EMS, you know, this is the time not to hesitate and go ahead and give that $5, $10, $20, whatever you can spare. I know times are hard and it is the holiday season. We have a lot of other expenses going on, but just, you know, maybe you can just do it at the coffee every day for a month. That's $30 right there. You know,
right.
So with that said, I don't want to, you know, I guess, you know, keep harping on it, but, you know, please, again, I'll put the links in the show notes, and you can go check it out on Facebook as well, Josh's page, and my fan page as well, at the EMS Professional over at Facebook. So the links are there for you guys to just simply click on it and donate. All right, so Josh, tonight, I picked this little topic here on patient assessment. I've actually been doing a lot of catching up my other EMS podcasting, listening to a lot of other EMS podcasts that are out there, and trying to get my finger on the pulse of what's going on in the industry, what some of the hotter topics are. And I tried to maybe take away certain things from the podcast and try to see what I can do to maybe kind of narrow it down a little bit more into a more you know, targeted discussion. And I thought that patient assessment would be a good topic, and not necessarily sit here talking about, okay, A, B, C, and all that other stuff that we do all the time, but talking a little bit about assessing the whole aspect of what we do when it comes to patient assessment, you know.
Now, you mean patient assessment like how far you park from the curb, and can they hear your sirens to
right.
come out
come
to
down,
the ambulance?
Can they walk down the stairs to us
right.
and, you know, come in the ambulance
just
with
come
their,
on
luggage,
in,
their luggage,
have a
or
seat.
Their medications? And,
right.
I'm talking, you know, because part of the the discussion that I've heard is how in classes, you know, the whole aspect of patient assessment isn't really taught as well as it should be getting taught. You know, this is really one of the bigger parts of what we do and what we should be focusing on. Yet a lot of times in school, you're focused more on the rigid skill sheet and following the skill sheet and remembering the ABCDs and the, you know, DCAP, BTLS and the step-by-step things you have to do to pass. And not necessarily the things that are going to benefit you or benefit your patients by doing a more proper patient assessment based on a patient's complaints, a patient's presentation, things like that.
Well, you know what? I'm going to be honest with you, Jim. When I read this topic, you know, when you sent me the email on what the topic was, and for folks who don't know, Jim puts together most of these topics. He scans the blogs and postings and finds out what's hot, what people are talking about, and the buzz. And every now and then we'll come up with an idea of something that happened to us on the bus or in our jobs, and we'll talk about it and then maybe put it up as a topic as well. But this one, you know, when I read about it, Jim, I was like saying, you know what, I don't know. When I was in the EMT class, we went over patient assessment pretty well. I mean, there was a lot going on, and yeah, it was a chapter like everything else, like, you know, ANP, like splinting, like bleeding control, all of those other things. Yeah, it was just a slice. But we went over it, and we did cover the idea, and we had a couple of good lectures. And I remember one of the lectures we had was, you know, a doctor who came in and said, look, you know what, the biggest thing you got to learn is to look at your patient and listen to your patient, because they're going to tell you what's wrong. But one of the things that I noticed that really is the gap and was most frustrating to me when I got out and started to work on a bus was the idea of writing up the EPCR, because we really didn't cover how do you take that patient assessment that you just did and tell a story so you can properly communicate and transfer patient care to the next level of care. And that's the thing that I think in patient assessment, which is the real gap. I mean, listen, there are people out there that can't take a blood pressure, and I don't want to speak to them. I didn't mean that way. It's not like I want to ignore them. I don't want to speak to them. I don't want to speak about that. There are definitely people out there who have not put together their skills correctly and are not prepared to be doing patient care.
I'm not really trying to pinpoint, you know, bashing people or saying
exactly
that people aren't trained in doing it.
That's exactly what I want to avoid, though.
What I'm trying to focus on is, I mean, I think that, but like you said, like you're saying you went over it. And I think that in class we should be doing a lot more than just going over it, you know, and just doing what we have to teach the students in order to get them to pass according to a skill sheet. You know, there should be a lot more scenario-based type things going on in the classroom, and I don't think that's really going on as much as it should. I mean, you get out into the street, and you're so stuck on, you know, following step by step according to a skill sheet that you would, you know, drilled into your head to pass your class, that, you know, you're doing things that aren't necessary for the patient that might be in front of you. You know what I mean? When you're taking your exams in class and all, you know, it's like you can't deviate from that skill sheet. You can't jump around according to what the patient is complaining about.
Right.
You know,
you still got to check for major bleed, even
right,
though the person's sitting in front of you on their kitchen chair.
Right. You
got to
verbalize it. Even if,
right,
even if, you know, you and I both know that that's not happening in the real world, but you've got to verbalize it for the instructor. And it's like nonsense. It's like you're doing it just to do it. I mean, there are times when you're going to do that. You have an unresponsive patient or the description of what happened to them before you got there. You might want to go ahead and start doing that type of thing, you know, but to just do it just because it's on a skill sheet, or to try to fit somebody into some type of a protocol, is where I think we're going wrong with that.
But to be honest, you know, how much do you see that being adhered to in the field? I mean, look,
well, when, it's not adhered to. I think once people get out into the field and they have that real hands-on training and
they're usually working with somebody hopefully that has a little bit more experience than them, and they don't do that. You know, you don't need
that
leave the longboard in the bus.
I think slowly that starts to change, and people realize that there's a real world aspect of patient assessment versus the classroom aspect of it. But why should there be such a different way of looking at it? Why can't we train like we practice or like we do, for the patients?
Because I think a certain amount of it needs intuition, needs your assessment intuition in gear, and I don't think that gets in gear until you've seen some patients.
And I think there are things. I think there is some merit to teaching the ABC thing. So you kind of got that in your head that you want to make sure the patient's breathing and that they have adequate circulation, they have an airway. But I think beyond that basic type thing and kind of keeping that in the forefront of everything that you're doing, you've got to kind of treat the patient according to their complaint and according to their appearance to you. Josh, you know what? I've got somebody on the line here. I think.
Awesome.
Let me see if they're still here. I know they've been on hold for a little bit. Let me just bring them in and see if they have an opinion here. Hi, are you still on the line with us?
Yes.
Hi, who is this?
This is Bob Sullivan.
Hey Bob, how you doing? I got your email. Thanks for popping in.
Glad to be here.
I know you said you're passionate about patient assessment. I mean, I don't know if you've been listening since the beginning of the show or not, but I mean, what do you think? Do you think that we're training adequately in the classroom for the field, or we can be doing it a little bit differently or better?
No, I don't think we do it adequately, and I think there are two things. Like some students seem to be so obsessed with the sample OPQRST, AEIOU, and they lose sight of the big picture. Right, and sometimes why. And so when I teach, and I don't know if it always is successful, but I say pretend every question that you're asking a patient is the last one that you're going to get. So even the very stable patients, pretend that they're going to go unconscious or stop breathing at any second, and think about what information you want to know while you're formulating your care plan, and sort of prioritize that way.
That's a good idea. I like that.
And the other thing is
we're going to start out with have you just taken any medicine or do you have any allergies to medicine? What's going on immediately, with that person?
Right. And, like with asthma or someone with COPD, I'll say, okay, the top things I want to know is, have you ever been this bad before? And yes, what happened when you were this bad before? And then you can kind of start to plan ahead how invasive you're going to have to be with them. So,
have you ever been intubated?
Yes, that's another one. And then you sort of, if they shake their head yes, I hope it wasn't this bad when the last time you were, because I don't want to do it.
But I think that's part of what I'm trying to get across is that if let's say you get that patient, we'll talk about asthmatics for instance, and that's the type of thing where I think we should be focusing our training on and letting people know that that is something that could be important to find out, the type of questions you need to ask in specific type of patient presentations. Going beyond just listen to lung fields, what are the questions you're going to ask asthmatic patients or the questions you're going to want to ask chest pain patients without leading them, and trying to get people a little bit of a format, to help them, focus and have that vectored assessment for each patient. Because every patient really, is different. You can't try to fit them all into that, like you said, that whole sample. Those are great tools to use, remembering those mnemonics to try to keep you on track. But I think that when it comes to the individual patient, you have to look at how are they presenting to you and be able to be flexible to kind of move around that patient assessment format to get what you need out of the patient so that you can go ahead and treat them appropriately.
I think the big problem that you have with the structured learning environment, and not to say that you have problems with how we teach today, although I know you do, but with the idea that you're going to learn DCAP, BTLS, your ABCs, and all that other bullshit, and then approach your patient that way, is that puts you in a box. That puts you in a rigid form of thinking. And, you know, how often, you know, we all remember, like, the first time that we were sort of enlightened that, you know, we have this person, they're basically looking to be A&O times three, and everything is looking fine. You're wondering why you're there, and suddenly you realize what they're saying to you makes absolutely no sense, and truly enough, they're AMS with a finger stick of 22. You know, and then you have to, that sort of shakes your world a little bit, and then you're saying, I need to think less in the box. I mean, these mnemonics will help me get to the diagnosis eventually, but I sort of have to look, you know. I'm sorry. Did you say what's your name again?
Bob Sullivan.
Bob. So, I'm sorry, Bob. You know, what Bob was saying is in terms of what do you want to ask as far as your first couple of questions, will those be the last questions you get? And yeah, I mean, if you're approaching somebody who's difficulty breathing, you hear that high-pitched wheeze from across the room, you sort of know that you're not there for, you know, an in-bleed, or you're not there for a trip and fall or something else. I mean, it's pretty practical you're there for an asthma, and what are the most important things you want to know for that asthma COPD-er? I thought that was an excellent point, Bob.
Well, thank you.
You know, and I think, listen, we're not going, listen, there is an element of experience that's going to, you're going to need in order to be able to focus on, you know, individual patients and how your kind of style of patient assessment is. You know, everyone has their own little style of it. And, you know, the goal is, of course, to complete and to do what is right for the patient and kind of doing those major components of your primary and secondary assessments, but being able to provide those treatments as you find problems or trying to identifying the things you need to identify that are more urgent than others, you know. It's funny because I set this topic up probably about a week ago, and I was looking online. It was actually a little quick article in EMS1 by Greg Fries, had a little quick tip on there about it, and he was actually talking very similar to what I'm talking about here about, you know, how patient assessment really shouldn't be a linear process. And he talks about, you know, what we're talking about, you know, now as far as, you know, providing treatments as you find them. You know, if they don't have a patent airway, of course, begin airway management and things like that. And some of the comments that some of the people made in his post is that, one person, you know, felt he didn't write enough about patient assessment, you know, and I was like, well, you know, it's in the short article. You're not going to cover everything that entails patient assessment in the short, you know, web article.
Right, and he just wants to bring this subject up.
I mean, he's probably given,
you know, knowing Greg, he's given a few examples, but there's a whole world of patient. I mean, you know, doctors spend years on patient assessment, depending on your discipline. I mean,
right. You
know, that can be a career.
And one guy I mentioned in the comments, he said, you know, and I mentioned this earlier before, is that how we have to remember and we have to kind of treat these skill sheets that we're going by as just as scoring devices for passing a practical, you know, station, a practical skill station, and that we really should be focusing more on learning and developing a method for the assessment, and kind of just leaving that skill sheet stuff, you know, for proctors to create a performance, and we should focus more on developing that the methods that we have to have for, you know, for patient assessment.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. What I was saying earlier, though, is I think connected to that, and what I find is the big gap in the field that when a lot of people enter the field, they just don't know how to make that continuum of patient care. And that's the thing that really I find more troubling.
Let me ask you this. Do you ever find partners or people, like, you know, when they get in the ambulance, they tend to start asking questions that have nothing to do with the patient's complaint, kind of looking for a zebra somewhere, you know, just trying to, you know, you get the patient who's got, you know, they hurt their wrist and you're asking if they're having chest pain just because it's part of the format they were taught in school, you know.
Well, I was thinking that exact example. I was thinking, you know, how many medics stop asking, you know, are you having trouble breathing as the lead in question, and instead, you know, ask, are you having any problems? Do you have any pain? Do you have any upper body pain? You know, and they're really circumspect about, you know, focusing in, because after everybody that I asked, are you having problems breathing? Well, why are you having problems breathing? It's like I stubbed my toe.
Right. It's also like, look at the patient. How does the patient look? Are they cyanotic? Do they look like having problems? Are they tripoding? Are they using the sensory muscles? You know what I mean? I mean, what do they look like? You know, what that question, you know, you can ask them that if down the line, if it doesn't seem to be the that main thing going on, if you're not obvious to you what's happening and you're trying to kind of figure out what's going on, you know, alone, as you're doing your assessment, things aren't just jumping out at you, and you ask that question, they say yes, and you, okay, now you're trying to figure out, well, why? Then, like you said, why are you having that problem?
You know, like, there's a couple of different ways of asking if you're having problems breathing, but the one, you know, the thing that I love, the example I love is, do you have any allergies? What an open question. Yeah, well, you know what? I had this allergy to chocolate the other day, or I have this allergy to a certain type of fabric, and I'm like, no.
I itch if I get this.
Yes, exactly. So you know what my first question is when it comes to known allergies is, do you have any allergies to any medicine? Does a doctor said that you can't have any type of medicine? And immediately now the person understands where this is in, you know, the context this is in, and they can say yes or no to that. What medicine? And then the next question is, and then it's usually what comes out with that is contrast dye or, you know, something else. And then you can say, do you have any food allergies or anything that, you know, really affects you? And they say, oh, yeah, I have an allergy to peanuts, or I have, you know, as an extreme example. But a lot of times you'll have, you know, mold or dander or something like that, or
right.
pollen.
Right.
And you say, okay, well, you know, join the rest of the population. But that's a way of, you know.
Hey Bob, do you instruct EMTs or medics or both, or?
Right now it's only paramedics.
Okay. Have you used those Brady videos, those scenarios for Brady that they have, where they give you the slide and give you the scenario and then you kind of walk through that presentation? You ever tried those? Ever seen those?
I've seen them. I don't use them. Most of my instructing now is in a lab
okay.
setting where we kind of make up our own. There's already like a set number of the college of scenarios that the college put together.
I gotcha.
I also precept students on their clinical rotations in the hospital.
That's cool too, Bob. Yeah, I mean, it's great to do. I mean, like, the lab setting thing is perfect as well. I mean, I think the key is to work as many of those scenario things as possible. And I've heard arguments that, well, if we start doing too many scenario things, there's too much of a perception-based, you know, answers to questions, and you're going to get into arguments with students about, you know, what they think is going on versus what you said, or, you know, not really seeing an actual patient in front of them. It's hard for them to figure it out, and it just makes it harder for the students to grasp, you know, what you're trying to get across to them. And I don't know why this mentality of just trying to make everything easy for everybody, you know, comes into play. You know, if you follow the ABCDE and you follow the, you know, sample and all that good stuff, you're going to pass. You just stay on track.
Well,
don't deviate from that.
I think that comes back to our protocols.
Well, that's the thing, too. I think those
that are very rigid.
I think a lot of times, too, in class, especially medical classes, too, where they work the patient assessments based upon a complaint, and they want you to kind of course, lead into what protocol you think that patient's going to fit into, and then treat them according to that protocol for standing orders, medical control, and on, and kind of get you to go through the whole, you know, process, which is good because it gets you, I guess, thinking, you know, how to put patients into protocols and how to treat them appropriately. But I think that, you know, I think that what happens is that you start getting people who get that mentality where that's all they want to do. They just want to fit somebody into a protocol and be able to treat them some way so they feel that they're doing something.
Bob, what part of the country are you working out of, by the way?
I'm in Wilmington, Delaware.
Oh, okay. So you're Northeast?
Yes.
All right. Do you work a bus, I assume?
Yes. Right now,
so
actually.
What do you find is the biggest – you're on a bus now. Cool. All right. If we hear the tones going off, we'll know that – we'll know. But if what do you find is the biggest disconnect between, you know, once your students leave the classroom and hit the field, you know, from the classroom to real life?
There's like this putting it all together, and I don't think they leave class knowing what information – to acquire during the assessment is important and what isn't. I know I learned myself in paramedic school and shortly after I worked as a tech in a hospital. And that was where I really learned, not that I was doing the assessment myself, but just working with doctors and nurses and watching the way that they would assess patients. And then patients would get dropped off by ambulances, and you'd get a report where, you know, you could tell the difference between the sharp medics, the ones who got paid attention to, and the other ones that would just, you know, go on and on and on. Either they wouldn't know anything and they would just say, well, we just picked him up and here he is. Or they would just go on and on about all this, like, nonsense and things that really didn't matter. And after
they had appendicitis in 81 and, you know.
Right. And you stop listening to them. After you know, on one side, providers complain that people at the hospital don't listen to them. The good one is that getting listened to is something that gets earned. And if you don't know what's important and what the staff needs to know, people are just going to tune you out after the first 10 seconds that you give your report.
Yeah, it's true, though. I think that's a good point, because I think when you show up in an emergency room and start rattling off all these negatives and positives that don't have any bearing on really what's going on with that patient. I mean, in the long run, that might have some bearing, but for the initial, presentation of the patient, you know, that's when I think you kind of get them tuning you out. And I think the same thing goes true, too, for, like, you call medical control on the phone, and you're trying to get orders for something, and you're just kind of saying stuff just to say it. You know, and the doctor's probably thinking, what the hell is going on? Why did this even guy even tell me this stuff for? What's going on with, you know, I don't care if this patient, has hemorrhoids. He's having chest pain. You want the morphine or not, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain aspect to that. It's like, especially when you bring them into the ED, you begin to learn what's important. You begin, and this is the thing that probably isn't, that's the part of the gap I'm talking about. What's important to the ED? What do they want to act? What are actionable items for them? You know, the patient had chest pain post exercise, general exercise. They've been a runner. They've been a runner, but today they've had chest pain. They ignored it for 3 hours. It got unbearable, so they had to come in. And then you give something like, you know, you give your treatments, what you did, what you saw on the EKG, because that's all important. Any pertinent allergies or things like that, because that they're going to action. But they don't really need to know this guy's drug history or what he's on right now. But what they do want to know is, when was their last oral intake? And one of the reasons they want to know that is because, are they going to send them right off to the cath lab? You know, is he going straight from the ER to the cath lab? And that's an important aspect because, you know, unless it's an emergency cath, they don't want the guy to have, you know, they want the guy to be or woman to be fasted for a certain amount of time.
That's a good question for trauma patients, too, if they're serious enough that they think they're going up to the OR for the same reason. And then for them to predict how difficult, you know, their airway might be, and it's something that we forget. And that's sort of down the list on things that you think are important, especially when someone's really sick. But for the hospital, is one, another thing that I didn't realize was important was we actually delivered a baby a few weeks ago. And as we gave our report and we were leaving, and one of the nurses came running out and said, "How did you cut the cord?" "Oh, we used the scalpel in the kit."
"Used my teeth."
And, yeah, I mean, she's like, "Okay, please tell me you didn't use your scissors." And I was thinking, of course not. But apparently someone at some time did, because they need to know if the cord was cut with something sterile, or else they need to give the newborn a tetanus shot. And then there's a whole other, procedures that they have to go through for that. So later, then someone else who delivered came in, "Could you believe they asked me why, if what I cut the cord with?" And I said, "Well, this is why." I'm like, "Oh, okay, well, that makes sense then."
Right. And you want to, that's an excellent point. Go ahead.
And they're just an overall disconnect. And I don't know, I mean, I think when we go to clinicals, especially at the EMT level, they spend so little time, you know, actually interacting with patients during training. And then at the ALS level, we go to the operator, we go to the ER, that's where we get our skills. And I think there's so much time that could be spent working on assessment that we're worried about our IV percentage and, you know, giving so many drugs from the different routes and stuff that, you know, assessment is so much more important than those things.
Yeah, but, you know, if you're in a decent ER, and this is not to disparage any of them, anybody that's listening, but if you're in a decent one, the nurses that you're charged to work under are going to work you, and you're going to be taking, I mean, I remember I took histories ad nauseum before I got to drop a single line, before I got to do anything else. Blood pressure history, blood pressure history. It may be the most tedious part of the job, and it may be the part that, you know, the scut work as far as the nurses were concerned, but at least I wasn't emptying bedpans.
Yeah, I think, you know, Josh, too, I mean, that's a good thing, Josh, as well. You know, I mean, I know when I was in school as well, that was one thing that I took it upon myself whenever I saw the docs and whatever, getting new patients in, and I would do my best to be with them so I could hear them, you know, get their history. I can hear them how they, did their assessment and questions that they asked that were important for that patient's complaint. And I think that helps in the long run. It helps you, you know, be able to say to yourself when you get a patient in front of you, whether that patient needs you to be going crazy and getting oxygen and worrying about their airway, or if you can go ahead and take your time a little bit and focus more on, you know, the abdominal pain that they might be having. You know, just because the patient's sitting in front of you telling you they're in cardiac arrest doesn't mean you start CPR. You know what I mean?
Right.
You can't go by everything that they say to you. You have to go by what your impression is and what how they present to you and kind of base your treatment and your exam on that, you know, and then build outward from that. So then once you get the basics going and you kind of realize that it's not this big life threat happening or whatever, then you can ask those questions, I think, that might not be, like you mentioned earlier, as far as like last meals and things like that, where that might not be the first thing in your mind, but it's something that it's good to know, and it's something that is a need to know once you get to the hospital.
Well, when you're approaching your differential diagnosis, and your differential diagnosis is basically now you're mixing some knowledge of operations with what your DX is. And you're saying, okay, this guy is having a STEMI. I know that this hospital is a cath hospital. I know that because now all STEMIs in New York, anyway, go to a cath hospital. So I know that they're going to cath this person. So what are they going to want to know that's above and beyond how long did they have chest pain and what elicited the chest pain and what made it better or worse? They're going to want to know, is there anything in the guy's stomach, because they're going to want to put him off to the cath lab. And like Bob was saying before, same thing goes for trauma or any surgical candidate. But you've got to start to understand what the process is so you can understand who's a surgical candidate and who's going to be sitting 11 hours in the ED and waiting for some blood chems to get back.
Right, and I think that's, I mean, part of that goes by,
having the experience, knowing the areas that you work in, the hospitals that you're working out of, and things like that. But again, it also goes back to, I think, as far as in the classroom, focusing more on the type of questions we should be asking these patients, what we should be looking for, and not just, you know, going over it as a chapter in a book and you know, focusing on to pass a test.
And some of it doesn't connect at all, because I remember. I mean, Bob, I don't know if you teach this or not. I'm pretty probably sure that you cover it in like a 30 seconds of conversation somewhere along the line in patient assessment. But when you're doing your patient assessment, isn't there somewhere that you ask them, hey, have you been to a foreign country or done any traveling recently? And yeah, that's a little bit of zebras instead of horses. But if, you know, that all came home to roost when we had the avian flu epidemic and, some of these things where people were bringing diseases from across waters or across transportation, international lines.
Right, but you're not going to ask the 90-year-old or nursing home patient if they've been traveling.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? Exactly.
So that's like the key thing. It's like, you know, it's knowing the questions to ask and when to ask them, and again, a lot of it is going to come from experience. You're not going to get it all in classroom. You know what I mean? It's not all going to happen in the classroom. But I think we should be starting the students on a path, at least in class, so that they're well on their way to recognizing and understanding that this is the type of training, the type of methods they should be developing for themselves. In class and then beyond, knowing that this is what's going to be the reality of the patients that we get and the treatment that we're giving.
So what are you going to – what would you – what direction – well, let me throw that over to Bob. You still there?
Yes.
Okay. So, you just heard what Jim said, and this is an aspect that he sees is missing from the classroom environment. Of what questions to ask when. We're not asking the nursing home patient if they've traveled recently. How would you integrate that or get what would you change in your teaching program to sort of close that skills gap?
I think the biggest challenge is just the time constraint, because there's so much more being that needs to be covered, and that students are supposed to be expected to know that unfortunately, I think assessment's one of the ones that places that we kind of like cut corners with. One of the things that I teach is before you're going to pull a trigger, before you give a medicine or do anything to a patient, whatever your initial differential diagnosis is, just think of two other things that it might be. Probably not, but just to get it in your hands so you don't get – it's sort of a guard against tunnel vision, just so you don't get so sucked into your initial impression being correct and then doing something that might, harm another problem that the patient might be having. Which I say just two others, no more than five. But that sort of is sort of like a guard. So then if someone has vague symptoms and, they're talking about, worried about SARS or H1N1, that might prompt them to think of something like that might be important to ask.
Yeah. I don't know, Jim. What do you think?
No, I think it's good points, and I think that – listen, I think the main thing that probably would probably help is if we took the train that we're getting is to extend it, make it so that we're putting this training into the classroom that we're talking about, not taking out stuff, because a lot of the stuff that with your training is valuable. And it's key points, that knowing a lot of these things helps us with the bigger spectrum of what we're doing. But we have to work into, I think, some of this bigger stuff that we're doing into the regular training, kind of mix it or get it in there into that training so it's all together. and that we're not just focusing on the ABCDs and the skill sheet, and that we are focusing on, you know, what questions to ask these certain types of patients. And you're not going to get every patient illness, every illness into the classroom. You're not going to be, okay, if you have a patient with, you know, pneumonia and, you know, and a UTI, and these are the questions you're going to ask that patient. You're not going to be able to do that, you know. But I think you can probably get a big percentage of the types of patients that we get, the more common patients we get, and get students on a path of the type of questions to ask them. And, you know, and people are going to build on that when they get out into the field and they get other patients that don't necessarily fit into those, you know, into that illness, but they'll know, okay, you know what, I really need to be asking questions that are more directed to this person's complaint and not necessarily to, a step-by-step skill sheet or a step-by-step something I've learned in the textbook.
Right, right. Again, and we sort of talked about this before, and I know how you hate when we go circular, but it's not only bridging that skills gap, but it's sort of taking that hodgepodge, that big jumble of tools in your toolbox, and not pulling every single one of them out for every single patient. You want to basically know which individual question is going to fit the diff breather. And I remember getting a sheet of, like, you know, like 5-10 major questions. They were broken up into two groups of five that you want to ask each group. And I don't know if they still hand those out or not, or they're around. But, you know, the things that you want to ask a pregnant female or OB comp versus an asthma versus if, you know, it's a conscious trauma versus
right.
straight medical versus a chest pain.
And I think that that is being
that's
done.
That's an excellent, yeah.
You know, I think that is being done. They are, you know, they do give students that that guidance, you know, on chest pain patients. What are you going to ask them? The whole, you know, scale 1 to 10 and the radiating pain and influence by movement and all that good stuff. But instead of telling them this is what the type of questions you have to ask these types of patients, they're not telling them what you don't have to ask. You know, don't focus so much on, you know, extremity things, you know what I mean? Or don't focus on different areas that have nothing to do with that complaint. And I think that is where the issue starts to kind of get confused, and I think that's where people start doing, like Bob had mentioned earlier, when you start just giving reports to people, on all these different things that have nothing to do with the patient's complaint.
Well, I like the cautionary, you know, instances that Bob referenced before, like, you know, before you're about to push a drug, think about your DX and what else it might be. Even though, you know, is it too far out? I mean, are you looking for that, you know, avian flu, or are you looking for that, you know, rheumatic, African tsetse fly fever? I mean, if you're looking that far out, it's probably not that, and you're probably all right. But review what your assessment was and why you made that assessment.
And I think, a lot of it goes back to getting the experience and getting your method of how you do it out there. But part of it, too, is being a professional provider and getting that additional training, seeking out, you know, the different presentations that patients, you know, present with, and, you know, realizing that not every patient is going to be the same, not every chest pain patient or cardiac MI patient would even be having chest pain. It might just be some slight discomfort. You know, you have to take their vital signs and look at the overall clinical picture. And I think by going ahead and educating ourselves and continuing education beyond the classroom is where, you know, we can kind of add that to our patient assessment skills.
Well, I like what, you know, you sort of where I was going with the second part of that is, you know, you were saying take your vital signs and, you know, get a full clinical picture. And it's like one of the things I was going to say is, yeah, I mean, don't forget your basic skills. Take your vitals. Look at the condition of the patient. You know, make that general assessment first. Is this person all diaphoretic, panicked, and sweaty? I mean, do you hear wheezes from across the room? Do you hear
a cough? Well, they're smoking a cigarette when you walk in the room, and you know, saying my chest hurts.
Oh Lord. Yeah. You know, with the nasal cannula in place as well.
Exactly.
It's like, sir, please put that, ma'am, please put the cigarette out.
Well, listen, I think we can end it there, Bob. Bob, you have any final thoughts you want to chime in with before we end the show tonight?
The only thing I was thinking when you talk about looking for zebras, I think that we as educators share some of the responsibility for that, because I think there's some people that they just want their students to know how smart they are, so they get these really complicated scenarios about a call they had once, and that, you know, they want the students to go probe and dig deep and think, you know, way outside of what most likely causes someone's symptoms are.
Right.
And
that can happen. But, I can definitely see, I mean, I've seen that happen, you know.
Yes.
But I think, like you said, I think that sometimes educators are kind of guilty of that. And to a point, it can help a student kind of realize that not everything is black and white, and that they have to kind of, you know, look for other things. But if a patient's presenting a certain way, then that's the way they're presenting. Right. Don't keep looking for something else, you know.
I used to have a partner that everything was a parasite. It's like, he has that brain parasite. I'm like, they don't have that brain parasite. You know, they have pneumonia. They have a cold. They have an upper respiratory. Would you stop that? Well, they threw up.
Right.
And they're dizzy.
Well,
one day
he'll be right, and he'll show you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know what?
Count on.
Broken clock is right twice a day.
Right. Exactly. Well, Bob, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your input. I really enjoyed it. You made some good points.
Oh, thanks. It was great to be here. I really enjoyed the show.
All right. Well, any week, any time you're free, feel free to drop in. We'd love to have you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Have a great night, Bob.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Yeah, Bob made some pretty good points, Josh. I think I love the whole treat every question as if it might be your last type thing to it.
Well, I like the that was great, and I'll be honest, there was a little vindication in the end, you know, when there was a little admittance on his side as part of an instructor that sometimes that they go into the zebra element, and I don't want to discount that. I mean, listen, we're supposed what makes us look brilliant is occasionally when we do catch those zebras, but it's not the mainstay and it's not the main course. And you know, they're why they're called zebras is because if you look around, you only find zebras in North America in zoos. They don't run wild,
right?
So you know, it's like that's why they're called zebras. So if you're doing this type of stuff, if you're listening to this call, I mean, everything that's been said, take it with a grain of salt, but at the same time, don't go caging yourself into a box. And I think that's your takeaway.
Absolutely. I mean, every patient's different. You know, you got to focus on, you know, on what the complaints are and work from there pretty much, you know. And again, you've got the patients that aren't responsive, and that's when you're going to run the whole gamut. That's when that step-by-step skill sheet, that step-by-step process is going to keep you on track. You know, but for a conscious patient, I think with that's able to speak to you and can point to things and you can visualize what's going on with them, I think that you can treat that patient or don't treat them, you know, based on what your findings are, you know, and not necessarily what they're always what they're complaining to. Like you said, you know, I'm in pain, but what do I can't breathe. What's it from? Oh, I stubbed my toe.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you have to kind of treat them going to the complaint, what your findings are. Not necessarily what their, you know, basic complaint is. You gotta do that assessment and figure out what the bottom line is and what's ailing them. So, well, I think it was a great call, Josh. Thanks for joining me. I apologize for my voice. Hopefully next week I'll sound a little bit better.
So I got a special announcement here, Jim. And I did this just for you. So now this can either be a good thing or a bad thing, depending if people actually listen to the show. But it's going to be for the next 24 hours. It's going to end midnight Monday night or slash Tuesday morning, whichever, however you count that. And okay. What I did is I put together a 25% discount for the listeners of this show.
Okay.
And I sent you that email. Did you get the email?
When you send it?
This afternoon, just before the show.
No, I didn't. I haven't checked that yet.
All right. So if your listeners want a new oxygen wrench, and we've talked about that, you know, this is my company, and I make a great O2 wrench that, if I do say so myself, but many other people say it's great. It's the only oxygen wrench guaranteed for life, as you know, and mm-hmm. you've told me before I shouldn't be shy about that.
Yeah.
I put together a 25% discount for listeners of your show.
Okay.
And all they have to do is on checkout, when they get down at the bottom of the shopping cart, there's going to be a little thing for a discount code. And if they type in EMS office hours, one word, they'll get 25% off their order, no matter if they order 1 or 20 or 100 wrenches at one point.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and try to add that on there, so that's where we can, into the show notes there, let people know as well.
Yeah, cool. So now we'll see. Do people actually listen to us? Is there anybody out there right now? Because this is there's a wrench for $999. It's the purple version of the TK1 or TK2. It's the lowest price that I offer. It's the lowest price I've ever offered on the wrenches. And at 25% off that, you're going to be getting a wrench for under $750. And it's free shipping. So
that's a good deal.
That's a pretty good deal, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Jim. So that's it.
All right, well, Josh, thanks for joining me. I had a good time. As usual, I think we got some good points across. Anyone listening out there, you have your own thought? You want to talk about something on the show? Be sure to drop me a line. It's jhoffman@ems-safety.com, and I will try to maybe even create an entire show on it or bring up your comments or concerns on the show and talk about what you are thinking regarding the EMS industry. Well, that's pretty much it. This is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours, and as always, stay safe.